The impeachment trial is gripping the nation. Chief Justice John Roberts is accusing senators of engaging in pedophaging. Yeah, what the heck is that? And my special guest today is Carrie Phillips. We're going to unpack how to do stand-up comedy. This and much more in this week's Debriefing of the Law. Welcome to Comedian of Law's Debriefing the Law. I am Joel Oster, your host, and today I have a special guest for you, a good friend of mine, Carrie Phillips. Carrie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Joel.
Now, Carrie, I met you a couple of months ago at a NSA convention.
That's right.
Now, NSA, just for my listeners, this is not no strings attached. That's not what this is about. This is about speaking, right? This is a National Speakers Association.
Absolutely, yes.
Has anyone made that connection before, that NSA has another meaning to it?
National Security Agency has come up one or two times.
Okay, all right.
So it has come up, yes.
All right. So you are a speaker. That is what you do. That is your calling card in life. You know how to maintain a crowd's interest.
That's what I do. I do facilitation training. I do keynote presentations. I've been doing this for just about 20 years.
20 years. You have been making a living talking for 20 years.
That is true, yes.
Now, do you talk at home with your wife?
Well, I don't have to. She guides most of the conversations, but yeah, I talk with her as well. In fact, I get a lot of my material for what I'm doing now from her, or my interactions with her.
Now, we're going to unpack that here in just a bit, but I want to finish the introductions here. So you're a lawyer.
That's correct.
Now, how did you combine... Because I got to admit, this is very interesting to me, since this is what I did in my career path as well. I was a practicing lawyer and then moved over into the area of public speaking. And you, I guess, paved the way before me. And that's what you did. So explain how that happened in your life, where you went from being a lawyer, all the glory and fame and My Cousin Vinny accolades that come along with being a lawyer, to, I guess, being a former lawyer. How did that happen for you?
Yeah, it wasn't really like that, the glory and the fame. What it was it was a steady paycheck. I enjoyed the people that I worked with. But what I found out, the reality was that most of the cases settled. They didn't go to trial. And I didn't get as much personal satisfaction out of it that I wanted. And so I went to work for a reinsurance company. And as an attorney, looking on the legal side of claims and litigation, but they gave me the opportunity to do public speaking on various topics. And I found out that I really did enjoy that.
So you worked for a reinsurance company engaging in public speaking. That sounds like a near impossible task. You had to make reinsurance sound interesting. I got to tell you, I'm about ready to fall asleep just even thinking about the concept. How did you do that?
Well, as a reinsurer, I was more focused on the law with the various attorneys that worked for us, handling claims and litigation for us. And I did speak at several continuing legal education conferences that they had on various topics, bad faith, lead poisoning. They were more legal topics.
Now, when you say reinsurance, my thought immediately goes to the duck. You know what I'm talking about? An Aflac? Is that reinsurance, or am I thinking something totally different?
That is not reinsurance. Reinsurance companies insure insurance companies, is what happens, is they insure insurance companies. It's reinsurance.
Even insurance companies get those annoying phone calls from insurance agents asking them to buy insurance. All right, I get that. So you go over to the area of reinsurance, and you found some way to make it palatable. So why humor? Because now I know you as being a funny man.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, just for our listenership too here, the first time I met Carrie, we were at an NSA meeting, and I believe you introduced yourself as the inventor of the salad bar sneeze guard.
That is correct. As I said, it wasn't just me. There were several of us, but that was one of our most important inventions that I thought we did.
You invented the sneeze guard.
What happened was, I used to be on airplanes. I traveled quite a bit with the company that I worked for. And that was back before the cell phones and people talked to each other. And inevitably, somebody would sit down and say, what do you do? And I say, I'm an attorney. And they'd say, oh, I've got this tax issue. I would say, well, I don't do any taxes. And they'd say, well, the tax issue is this. They would just keep talking. Then you know, somebody would say, well, yeah, I have this this real estate issue. I said, well, I'm not a real estate attorney. And they'd say, well, the problem is, and they just keep talking. So what I started doing, when if somebody asked me what I did, I told them that I was a salad bar coordinator for a restaurant. I said, it wasn't just me, but several of us, we invented the sneeze guard. And then just after 2 seconds, they just looked at me, and that immediately stopped the conversation, and it just worked wonderfully.
I got to admit, that would not stop it for me. That would just open up an entire flight's worth of topics and questions I might have. Like, what goes on the salad bar? I mean,
if they do that, then I just went with it. I would just go with it and start talking to them about it and talk about the science behind it, and that if you put the celery before the tomatoes, it throws off the salad portions. And I was just absolutely making it up.
There is a science behind the salad bar. I don't even know if salad bars still exist today.
Well, I told them also that actually what the reason that I was out, I was going around to various restaurants to do presentations on the salad bars and how they should be done and explain the science to them. And I told them I could go in a lot more detail if they wanted. And usually that's about the time they picked up that Sky Mall magazine and the conversation.
Oh, see, I would think your worst nightmare would be to sit next to someone like myself, because that would just be perking my interest. And I think I am everyone's worst nightmare on flights.
Is that right?
Oh, I think I am, because number one, I fly Southwest. And as you know, and as anyone who has ever met me knows, there has not been too many dessert trays I have said pass to in my life. I love to eat.
Well, I don't want to offend people. If they bring it by, I just think it's just common courtesy to take some.
That's my outlook on life as well. I often tell people I love to exercise. It supports my favorite hobby, which is eating. I love to eat. And so my point there is, as you know, in Southwest, it's a cattle call. You can sit wherever you want.
Absolutely.
And so invariably, I'm late trying to catch my flight. And so I'm walking on there, and I'm like, C-72 or whatever. And as I'm walking down the aisle, I can see the fear in people's eyes as they're going, oh, please, no, don't sit next to me. Please don't sit next to me. You are way too big to sit next to me. And so I'm everyone's worst nightmare in that regard. But also, I'm a talker. Are you a talker on the planes?
Not usually anymore. Normally, I have got my headphones on. I'm listening to something, but not as much. But in the area, the waiting area, I will talk a little bit more then.
Oh, I'm a talker. Yeah, I sit down there, and once I get going, I'm telling you, it is not turned off until we are unloading that plane. And so I think I am everyone's worst nightmare. But I will tell you, there are rules that I follow. And so if you are a talker as well, let me just kind of tell you what some of these rules are. Rule number one, you just ask a question. So if I'm sitting down there next to you, I'm going to ask a question. I'm going to just start it off. And if you don't even look my way, right, and you just mutter some response and you don't even give me a side glance, I know you're off limits. You're not a talker. You don't want to talk to me. Message received. I will leave you alone. But if you turn your head and look at me and we engage in dialogue, I sense you're fair game.
That's right. Absolutely. You've done that. It's a little easier to identify the people that don't want to talk because they will have headphones on. May or not be on. They may or not be actually listening to any music, but they are sending out a very clear sign that they are not interested in an idle conversation.
Exactly. And the problem I have with talking, because I am a talker, is I have no idea when do you stop.
Right.
You know, I mean, you get going, you have a conversation, but you obviously can't get up and leave.
That's right. You do have a captive audience.
Right.
And those of us that speak for a living do enjoy a captive audience.
And we're lawyers.
Well, yeah. And also, they're not our spouses. And so we can tell the stories over. You know, my wife gets tired of the stories over and over again. And you get, you know, I do believe in the adage, it's easier to get a new audience than new material. Yes. And so quite frankly, because of what I do, if I do have somebody that is receptive and we are talking, I literally try out bits on them.
Oh, fresh material there, right?
Absolutely.
Fresh audience, raw ground. That is a great idea.
And it's easy to do because you can tell them, well, what's the worst airline experience? What's the best airline experience? What's the funniest airline experience? And they'll tell you.
I like it. Well, speaking of humor, that is what today's podcast is going to be about. It's going to be about humor and the role that humor plays in our life. I like to start off my podcast with doing headline news. Now, this week, there's not a lot of headline news. I scoured the news cycle. It's pretty much all about the Chiefs being in the Super Bowl, KU's brawl against K-State, and the impeachment proceedings. Now, I assume you are not an avid follower of the impeachment proceedings. You actually have a life. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say. I do read about it, but I'm certainly not following it real time.
All right. Now, it is a trial.
I know.
And we're lawyers, and so I would have to assume that's got to get everyone's attention. But first day of the impeachment proceedings, it goes to, I believe, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You got 100 senators out there. They're the jury. And you got the Chief Justice, who, by the way, has a day job. I mean, all these other senators, they're not doing anything else the next day until trial starts. The Chief Justice, he has to hold court the next day. But nonetheless, he is there presiding over the impeachment. And he had enough, I believe, is somewhere around midnight Eastern time. Finally, he had enough. And so he got up there and he said, look, you guys, this is one of the more esteemed civic bodies in the world. You are setting the examples, and you guys are a bunch of kids fighting. And did you hear what he actually said? Did you hear the word that he...
I wasn't familiar with the word.
I don't even know what the word is. I'm Googling it right now. Okay. Do you remember what it was? I don't either, because it is such a weird word. I had no idea. I had to Google it. I have it up on my computer right now. Pettifogging. What in the world is pettifogging?
I do not know. Yeah. I do not know. That's what they were engaged in.
The Chief Justice at midnight had enough. Says, guys, stop engaging in pettifogging. I have no idea what that was about. It would be fascinating to be one of his kids.
Well, also, it's going to be interesting how they're going to change their behavior if they, in turn, do not understand what the word means.
Yeah, yeah. So apparently his point was he was referring to a 1905 trial where a judge, Charles Sweeney, who was impeached but acquitted of the charges. And so apparently during that trial, someone was rebuked for using the word pettifogging. Apparently that is some kind of slang. I don't know if you want to use that in the basketball court as trash talking. I have no idea. It does make me remember another Supreme Court justice, the late, great Justice Scalia. And in one, I believe it was the King v. Burwell case, he said the majority was engaging in what was the word that he used? You remember? He said it wasn't hocus pocus. It was... it's escaping me right now. Jiggery pokery.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm unfamiliar with that word.
Yeah. Apparently, these justices sleep with thesauruses under their pillows, and so he came up with the word jiggery pokery. But no, apparently that was his joke there at midnight. Well, I want to talk now about humor. The Chief Justice thought that it was appropriate to use humor during the impeachment trial, but I believe in your career, you're drawn to humor.
I am drawn to humor. I saw fairly early on in the presentations that I was given that it's necessary, because while you might have a captive audience that is interested in...
You mean when they're snoring and drool is coming out of their mouths that you thought it might be important to maybe wake them up somehow?
There needs to be a way to maintain their attention over an extended period of time. And humor oftentimes acts, I've used it as a segue between things I was talking about, and sometimes just fit in with what we were talking about.
Yeah. Now, John Cleese, you know John Cleese is?
Certainly.
Monty Python fame. He said, he who laughs most learns best.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. And yeah. I also believe they talk in comedians that it is easier to keep people laughing than it is to get them to laugh.
All right.
And so the idea that fairly early on that you can... inject a little humor into whatever you're doing, that does have a tendency to relax everybody.
Okay.
And it makes the learning opportunity a little bit better, I think.
Now, so you decided that you should add humor to your presentation, and it would enhance the message that you are delivering.
Well, yes, Joel. As you know, I am a member of the National Speakers Association. I've been with them for several years there. And what I've noticed is that at a binary level, I'm talking very high, there's two types of speakers. And for lack of a better word, there are content speakers and there are entertainment speakers. Now, the concern that people have with hiring a content speaker is that they won't be entertaining. And the concern they have about hiring an entertaining speaker is there won't be any content.
All right.
And so I have spent most of my time talking about content-specific information. I started looking at my bio, and I've got some designations after my name. And I looked at it, and I said, people don't know that I do inject humor, that I can be funny. And so I decided that I needed to be funny. And how could I actually actively do that? And so I started doing open mics, stand-up comedy.
Now, before we get there, so were you funny before that? I mean, I'm talking high school. I mean, growing up. And I'm not talking your wife. Of course, your wife does not think you're funny. By the way, I actually talked to a friend of Kevin Hart. You know who Kevin Hart is?
Certainly.
Yeah, the funniest guy in the world.
Right.
And I talked to a friend of his, and he told me this story that he said, my friend said, what is one thing that every single comedian has in common? Their wife does not think they're funny. He said, yes, even Kevin Hart, his own wife, does not think that he is funny. So I definitely think that we are okay then. If our wives do not laugh at our jokes, we're in good company. Neither does Kevin Hart. But nonetheless,
I tell this joke, and it's a true story. I came home to my wife one time, and I said, hey, Becky, I talked with a comedian, told me he's written 400 jokes. And she said, yeah, and his wife's tired of every one of them.
That is the absolute truth. That is the absolute truth. She's heard it 400 times. But so were you funny in high school?
Well, it's interesting that you would ask me that, because it did remind me of something. That was, I was in the high school play in my high school. And, of course, you practice rehearse it for about a week,
yeah.
And you never have an audience. And so you're just going through the motions. We didn't really know what we were doing. But then we had the parents and other people showed up, and we started the play. Well, I had a couple of lines, and people laughed.
Okay.
And I found out I really liked that.
Did you know that line was going to get a laugh?
If I did, I'd forgotten it, because we'd rehearsed it so many times that it had never gotten a laugh before. I guess it was supposed to be funny. But when we said it to the public, they laughed.
Okay.
And I found myself attracted to that laughter.
Now, when you say attracted, what do you mean by that? Because I got to tell you, I get what you're saying. I'm just wanting you to articulate that.
Well, what I meant was that I said some words and they laughed about it and I enjoyed it. And so then I said my next lines, but I added visuals. I mean, I started doing it. What I'm telling you, Joel, is I got into it.
Yeah.
I gravitated toward trying to get more of that laughter, and I found out that I really enjoyed it.
I mean, isn't it almost like a high?
It's definitely a high, most definitely a high.
I mean, I remember delivering a sermon, and I told some jokes, and the people laughed at the jokes. I'm telling you, the rest of the week, I could not sleep. I would wake up at 3 a.m., re-delivering that joke in my mind, reliving the laughter. It just, for those who engage in public speaking, who are wired to do public speaking, it's a natural high.
It absolutely is, and it's something that you don't forget. And I did find myself continually wanting more of it. I enjoyed it.
You're a junkie.
I certainly am in that regard. It's a more healthy junkie, I believe.
I hope so, though we might get to that point and maybe come to a different conclusion. But no, I agree. That's a natural high. That's how we are wired.
Right.
I think everyone is wired to crave laughter. Now, I know not everyone is wired to tell jokes. We're going to get to that in just a bit, but I believe that everyone was designed to laugh. And so I've actually done a test for people. Let's see if you can take this test and see how you fare. I got tickets for you. The weekend's coming up. I got tickets. And I know which ticket you're going to pick, but I'm going to go ahead and ask you anyways. This is my laughter test. I got front row seats to a funeral or to a Jerry Seinfeld concert. Yes. Which ticket would you rather have?
I'll have the Seinfeld, please.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how delicious that potato salad is. No one would rather go to a funeral than to a comedic concert.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I did hear Jerry Seinfeld tell this joke where he said, you know what people's number one fear in life is?
What's that?
Because it's not death. It's public speaking, which means that if you were at a funeral, you would rather be the one in the casket than the one giving the eulogy. But nonetheless, that does not apply to us. We were wired to do public speaking.
Right.
All right. So do you buy into that premise that we are designed to crave laughter?
I believe that we're designed to pursue pleasure or avoid pain. And in the context of humor, what I found out is that if I got laughter, I wanted more of it. I got pleasure out of it. Now, the difference between my response to it and some other people is that if you try out a joke and it doesn't work and people don't like that silence or the crickets, and so there's too much pain, you know, when that happens to them. I have found myself, you know, completely blotting that out. That is, I'm still going for the pleasure.
Okay.
And so at a binary level of pain and pleasure for me, if it doesn't work, I'll try something else. Because I do want the laugh.
Now, if you attend one of my classes on using humor in law, and I teach continuing education classes for lawyers, where we talk about how we use humor in our practice. If you attended that class, you would know if you bomb, it's no big deal. In fact, I have some tricks that make sure you never feel the pain of bombing. And there's some tricks to that, which maybe we'll uncover today. It might be a future podcast, or maybe you have to attend one of my classes. I don't know, but we can unpack that in the future. All right, well, back to my premise. We were designed to crave laughter. Right. And so we all like that. We're all kind of designed that way. Now, I'm just curious. You mentioned you're buying into that premise just a bit, and you're wired that way as well. Do you find yourself wired that way outside of telling jokes? In other words, you said you like to be a, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but a people pleaser. You like to bring joy. Do you find yourself doing that even outside of telling jokes? Does that impact other areas of your life?
I look for the funny, and I always have. Again, there's a time and a place for it. I'm certainly aware of that. But I am consciously looking for opportunities to be amused. And quite frankly, I mean, when you do the headlines and the things that you do, and I've seen you your presentation several times, very funny. There are multiple opportunities to be amused all the time.
That is true.
And I do. I appreciate that.
Yeah, sometimes you don't have to look that hard.
Don't have to look that hard. Absolutely. Yeah. It's out there if you're aware of it. And then, like I say, I consciously pursue it now.
Okay, so I want to continue with that thought then. So you were doing these presentations on reinsurance. People were sleeping. No, they weren't sleeping. But you felt a desire to add humor to that presentation. So then where did it go from there?
Well, it just increased. I told the story in this one presentation that I was given was the breakout of attorneys per state. And I got a laugh for this. I started doing it every time. How many attorneys per person in a particular state? And then I would always end on the research I had years and years ago that the ratio of attorneys to people in the District of Columbia was 22 to 1.
22 to 1?
There was one attorney for every 22 people, according to this one study that
wow.
I had read. Now, everybody looks at that, and they're just kind of going, wow. And then I always end it with, now that, ladies and gentlemen, is reason enough alone not to let them become a state.
Which, I would agree with that.
Which got a good laugh. It got a good laugh. And so I saw that, and then I saw what we might talk about a little. I saw the tag. I saw the way to give out that information and then add a tag to it, which made it a nice little joke.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
It just happened to be true.
Right. Now, I want to get there. So you mentioned tag, and I want to get to why that was funny in just a bit. But all right, so in your career, though, you decided that you wanted to add humor to your class. And so I believe you mentioned you decided to do stand-up comedy. Now, what was that like the first time? I can just imagine the nerves you had standing in front of an audience. And it was probably a cold set. It was probably the light was shining in your eyes. You couldn't see a blessed thing. And you have to make people laugh. That had to have been just exhilarating and terrifying at the same time.
Well, for me, it was just absolutely petrifying. Now, I'll admit that I had set the bar low. My objective was to simply stand up there and talk for 3 minutes.
Okay.
Which is what I did.
All right.
But you're absolutely right, Joel. Normally, in the workshops and the presentations I do, I have sort of a captive audience. People have paid money to come there, so they have some interest in the topic. But when you do stand-up comedy at an open mic, I didn't know anybody in that room. Most of the people were much younger than me, and they owed me nothing.
Okay.
The whole idea is that you're up there in front of them with the light on you, and they're all sitting there, for the most part, is make me laugh. And I found that incredibly intimidating.
Oh, man, I got it. And I, despite what we're saying right here, I'm going to encourage every single one of you listening, do open mic night. Trust me, irrespective of what we're saying now, but nonetheless, I do want to encourage you to do it. You haven't lived until you've tried to do open mic night. So the story I tell my class is, I have argued before Judge Calabresi of the Second Circuit in multiple circuit courts. My cases have gone before the U.S. Supreme Court. And I got to tell you, nothing pales in comparison to the nerves you feel trying to make a room full of drunk college kids laugh. Now that is living, but nonetheless, it's an exhilarating moment.
Well, it absolutely is. The thing that you find out about yourself is that what happens when they laugh and what happens when they don't laugh. Because there are people that really get uncomfortable up there when people don't laugh. And then there are other people. They may be up there for 3 minutes and get one laugh. And all they remember is that one laugh.
Well, that was my
theory.
Those
people are going to make it. Those people are going to make it because they are looking for the funny. They will continue to chase the laugh.
Because I got to tell you, I had a complete opposite approach than what you had. And the first time I did open mic night, again, I was as nervous as can be. And someone had told me, or I had heard of somewhere, that you have 3 minutes for open mic night. You don't have to use all 3 minutes. In fact, no one has a stopwatch on you except the person who's going to yank you. So once you get them laughing, say, "That's all I have for you, folks. I'm out." And that's what I did. I probably went 1 minute, got a laugh, and I said, "That's all I have for you. You've been a great audience." Over and out.
If we do get into the tips and tricks a little later, that will be one of the ones we'll talk about, is when are you done?
Yeah.
You know, and that is, you mentioned Seinfeld, the George Costanza.
Right,
you say something funny and you leave, because you leave on a high note.
And no one has a stopwatch on you. And so they think you're funny.
Absolutely.
Because you left on a high note. All right, so I do want to go there. Because a lot of people listening, they maybe want to be funny. They want to do open mic night. They just have no idea how to do it.
Right.
So how do you do it? How do you go about writing a joke?
Well, what I've done is I'm a storyteller in my workshop. One of the things that I learned about doing the open mic is you only have 3 minutes. A lot of the presentations I have, I may do a keynote presentation. I have 50 minutes.
Yeah.
And I have 1 day presentation, so I have plenty of time to tell the stories. But when you do it in open mic, you have 3 minutes, so you've got to get to it. And so, first, what is funny? And that is what, and I do believe myself personally, I'm not an outlier. A lot of the things that I find funny, other people find funny. And so I look around for things that have happened. I did find myself writing them down. That's the one thing. What do I think is funny? And then consciously looking for it.
So what do you mean by that? I mean, you that's kind of a circular in reasoning. You say, what is funny? What I think is funny. Well, that's kind of, again, circular reasoning. What makes something funny?
Well, I have two questions in another presentation that I give. On the power of the question, the two overarching questions, which are, what does this mean? How can I use it? Those, I believe, are questions that people should ask all the time. If you have some type of visceral response to something that happens, if you were to analyze that, why did that just happen? What about that resonated with me? It can be humor. It can be poignant. There's a lot of different ways to go. But if something affects you emotionally in some way, you get into the habit of analyzing it. What I started doing with regard to comedy was thinking about things that struck me as funny and start analyzing why did I think that was funny. For example, the comment from my wife, I talked to a comedian he's written 400 jokes. My wife said, yeah, and his wife's tired of every one of them.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was just, it's very short. I wasn't expecting it. You know, it was so pithy, and I thought it was, and it was true. And
right.
Also, in addition to being funny, I thought it was true. And as you indicated, Joel, you've been in a similar situation that seems like a lot of spouses just don't think we're that funny. You know, we think we're hysterical. They're not as, they're just tired of it.
Yeah, well, you know, we can cut them a little bit of slack because I don't have new material. I try the same jokes over and over and over. The long-standing joke I always do with my wife is she'll say, you need to take the trash out. It's like, I already took the dog out. Or, you already walked him. You know, I keep using that joke over and over and over again, describing her dog as the trash. But nonetheless, you just actually mentioned a really solid tip on how to be funny. And so in my class, we actually go through the 6 to 10, depending on how much time we have, you know, common trigger points that you can use to make someone laugh. You cut right to the chase. In other words, you can skip those 6 to 10 common trigger points and you go right to the notebook method. Now, you didn't call it the notebook method, but that's kind of what I got from what you said. In other words, you'll observe something that you think is funny. And we all have a laugh component to our psyche. We see what's funny to us. And either you jot it down, which I highly recommend, or at least you make a mental note of it to come back to it later. But if you jot down funny things that happen, I'm telling you what, as Michael Costanza said, or who, someone on Seinfeld said, that's gold, Jerry, that is gold.
Well, also, if you're paying attention, if you have children, the opportunities to develop material all over the place. For example, I remember when my daughter was 6 years old, she came up to me one time and she said, Daddy, what does power mean? And I was thinking about it, trying to figure out where she was going with it. And I said, well, honey, can you use it in a sentence? She said, sure. What does power mean? I found that very funny. And she was going, Daddy, why did you, wasn't that a sentence? I said, yeah. She goes, why did you tell me to use it in a sentence when I said, I don't know. I mean, so
right.
I learned something about myself. I thought it was very funny that she did that. And so there's all sorts of opportunities if you're paying attention.
Yeah, you write that down. I said you can make a mental note of it. Scratch that. Don't make a mental note. Write it down. When you get old.
Well, I absolutely have to for what I do. And if we go into more detail about if you get them all together and then you can kind of segment them, then you can figure out what jokes work where.
Exactly. Well, I want to go over some of the jokes that you have done. By the way, you have a great website. It's your Facebook page. You also have a corporate website that you tell these jokes on?
Of CarryPhillips.com, yeah.
Okay.
I'm transitioning more into the humor part of it, but it has to do a lot with the workshops and presentations that I do.
Okay, so I want to go over some of these jokes that show up on your website. I get them through your Facebook feed.
Right, right.
But they also are on your website. And I want to unpack... How did you write this joke? In other words, what were you thinking? Where did this joke come from? What makes it funny? Just kind of want to unpack it just a bit. All right, the first one you have here. If anyone from New York City ever tells you something is within walking distance, ask more questions. I love that joke. That is hilarious. How did that come to be?
Well, what happened was, it goes back to the two questions that I was explaining in a presentation once. What does this mean? How can I use it? And that is, a lot of times people aren't clear about what they mean. And I use an attorney's example. That attorney calls me up in Texas, tells me about a case getting ready to go to trial. And I say, what do you think our chances of winning are? And he says, I think they're pretty good. So I approve his litigation plan. He goes outdoors, more discovery. 3 months later, $30,000 in legal fees later, I call him up and say, hey, when you said you thought we had a pretty good chance of winning the case, what did that mean? We weren't actually communicating. And the same thing on a personal level, my daughter that lives in New York City, you know, if anybody from New York City tells you something is within walking distance, you need to ask more questions. Because I talked to her one time and she said, oh yeah, you just walked down here. Well, walk down here, it was like 2 miles.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
From being in the Midwest, that is not just a leisurely walk.
Yes.
All right. And so I needed more definition. I needed more certainty as to what we were talking about. Absolutely.
Now, so how did you, because I love New York City. I've had several cases in New York City. Whenever I go there, I make sure to spend an extra half day at least on both ends just to walk the city. I mean, I love New York City. My wife and family have been up there. So I find this hilarious. But how did this joke come to be? I mean, literally, how did you write this joke? When did it come to you as a comedic idea?
It came to me, I saw the need to end this particular portion of my presentation on something that was funny.
Okay.
Because I was talking to a group of people, there were lawyers in the room talking about, be clear with what you're asking your attorney to do and make sure that you and the attorney are understand. And to give the example, we got a pretty good chance of winning this case. That was not clear or specific enough. And so, again, that made the point that we need clarity, and a lot of times it'll be numbers,
okay,
especially in your business. But I wanted to, you know, to have something funny, a more personal, humorous part. And that did happen. You know, Taylor did do that.
So this was to fill a hole in your presentation. You had this idea. You wanted to somehow illustrate the need of asking more questions. And then did it just dawn on you to make a connection with New York City?
It would be more along the lines of, well, you mentioned the George Costanza Seinfeld. He says, when you say something funny, end it.
Yeah.
And what I found myself is, if I was going to be talking about one thing and going to another, I found myself ending on a joke. And that is something that was funny, trying to find something that was funny. And it's the joke, the humor served as a segue to move into another topic.
Right.
Is what it was.
Now, one of the principles or common trigger points for laughter is called recognition. So in other words, if you hear something and you have an aha response to you, aha, yeah, I recognize that. I've been there before. I've done that. I've experienced that. So you recognize it. That's a common trigger point for laughter. And that's how, to me, why this is so funny is I have lived this out. My wife and I went to New York City and we wanted to see the city. So we thought, let's walk it.
Right.
And yeah, you don't drive your car in New York City. You walk it. And so we started on one end. It was only like, I think, a couple miles. We walked all the way to the other end down by where the Ground Zero is. And yeah, and also I noticed there was no one really like me in New York City. You know what I'm talking about?
Well, I'm telling you that the people in New York City identify people that are not from New York City very quickly.
Yeah.
Quite frankly, my wife, my daughter that's lived there now for 3 years, it takes great pride in the fact that everybody knows now that she's a New Yorker.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they do treat you differently.
Well, this one, in fact, you can even Google it now, but this one newspaper in Orlando, Florida wrote a story on me and the law firm I worked for back when I was in Orlando, Florida, and they described me as a bulky redhead. and so, yeah, there's not too many bulky people there in New York City, because when you're walking all the time, you're not bulky anymore. So
no,
they're all skinny.
True. Absolutely true. Yeah. I agree with that.
All right. And the next joke here you have, my vision for 2020 is unclear and the irony isn't lost on me. A hilarious joke. I like it. How did you come up with this joke?
That was one of my most widely viewed things on there. It was the concept of 2020. And that as I saw 2020, I had recently gotten, you know, my vision checked, and the idea that adding the unclear was just a nice, tight little joke. And so I thought it worked, and it did. I got good feedback on that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so I was happy with that.
All right, how about this one here? I'm amused when companies talk about treating their customers like family. Really? They think that's a selling point? Now, I want to know, what is the genesis behind this joke?
Well, there's the old adage that most people think they're from a dysfunctional family. They put the fun in dysfunctional. And every Thanksgiving, not as much Christmas, but Thanksgiving, there are all these articles about getting ready for the Thanksgiving dinner when Uncle Charlie's going to be there and Aunt Betty may be in her cups. And how are you going to address that? And the politics is a hot topic. There's all sorts of do's and don'ts that people have. And so when I see marketing or advertising talking about their employees or their clients, sometimes we treat you like family. Again, that does make me ask, what does that mean exactly?
Let's hope we treat them somewhat better than coming down in our underwear and just having a yell out match.
Oh, my goodness. I absolutely agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit better. All right. One more joke here that I really like. This one. Greta Thunberg at 16 was nominated for a Nobel Prize. My daughter at 16 put a sock over a light bulb and damn near burned our house down. So that is a... Is that a true story?
That is absolutely a true story.
Okay, explain.
That. I was talking to her after that happened, and I said, so walk me through that process. And she said, well, I thought if I put a blue sock over the light bulb, maybe I would have blue lighting. It would be mood lighting. And I said, did that happen? She goes, well, it was kind of orange red because of the fire. You know, and then the other one is, yeah, we're always hearing, Joel, that our children are our future.
Right, right, right.
Okay, which children?
I mean, we pick?
Greta or mine? I mean, like I say, that's kind of a little broad, too.
Right, right.
The idea behind that. And so when you see somebody that has garnered some international attention, and then you see, you know, what your children have been up to, there's quite a variation.
Yeah, that is a really good point. Whose children can we pick and choose? I sure hope we can. But nonetheless, well, Carrie, it's been a blast having you on today. Now, I do want to close with this thought. We are both really big into this stand-up open mic comedy concept, and we're doing it together. In fact, for future podcasts, what I intend to do is have you back on where we can kind of walk through our sets that we do.
Sure.
So we'll play them and then kind of walk through the process on how do we come to those jokes. Now, I'm going to tell you that there's a reason why we're doing this.
Right.
One of the reasons we're doing this is I know this is true for me. Maybe it's true for you as well. We're working on our own special.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea of having some type of objective with regard to it, the people that do this for a living always ask, how many strong minutes do you have? And a lot of people, that you need at least 45. And people that are being honest, a lot of times I think, I've got five, I'm looking for six. I mean, it is a process.
Yeah.
And somebody once told me that if you can write one good joke a week, that's 52 jokes, you've got yourself a special.
Wow.
My wife used to always say, I don't care what you're doing, whatever you're doing, over a period of time, it degenerates into work. But you get into a process where you set a goal or objective of getting that good, solid joke. Then you go to an open mic and you try it out. And if it really, really funny, then you can put that away. They laughed a little bit, then you work on it, you figure out how to make it funny, and then you move on. There is a process.
Yeah, and periodically we're going to check back in to see how we're doing, and we will air some of our open mic night experiences to see if they worked, didn't work, because not all these jokes actually kill. Right.
Absolutely not. That's the whole idea. I used to do quite a bit of process work. And in order to get best practices, you got to look at practices. And in order to get good jokes, you've got to tell jokes. And you can tell your jokes, and you've got people that will, you know, they laugh. I mean, they're friends of yours. But you go to an open setting like that where you don't know that many people, you find out whether or not it was funny.
Yeah,
and so the thing about an open mic night is that it's all about the audience. They will let you know if what you've done is funny.
And that is what I love about comedy. When you have a good audience, we've been before good audiences in the past, there's an immediate response. I mean, if you said if it doesn't work, you know it didn't work. It got crickets.
If you're looking for immediate gratification, then come up with a good joke. But then figure out what you're going to do when it doesn't work. And that is, if your objective is the one good joke a week, and then what you do a lot of times is you've got some good jokes, then you sandwich in something that you're working on, and then you always end on the high joke, and that way the good joke, and so that you always walk off that stage with something that went well.
Right.
But that is a process, but you've got to try them out. It's not all gold.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on today. Again, my main theme of this podcast, if you will, is that legalism sucks. And I think legalism is the killjoy in life. And I think it's a theological point there, but it's also just a main point in life that when we are freed up to really enjoy one another and to give forgiveness to one another and to love on one another, that's just the better way to go through life, in my opinion. So I'm constantly looking for ways to look for the funny, look for the joy in life, and then hopefully to spread that joy to others. So thank you so much for coming on, and hope to have you on in future podcasts.
Joel, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.